Welcome to a conversation about AmeriBoer futures with Dr. Richard Sander. Today's podcast is brought to you by the NIBA and made possible with the support of Straits Financial. This is John Nelson of Applied Research, and I'm happy to be joined today by Dr. Richard Sander. Doc Sander is the chairman and CEO of the American Financial Exchange. He is widely known as the father of financial futures for his work in developing interest rate futures at the Chicago Board of Trade. He has also been called the father of carbon trading for his work as founder of the Chicago Climate Exchange. Doc has far too many awards to mention here and has academic affiliations at many universities around the world, including Berkeley, Stanford, Columbia, Northwestern, and the University of Chicago. So, Doc, welcome. First question for you. How are you doing? How are you getting by during the virus, the shelter in place, all these things that we've been dealing with the last few weeks?
John, thanks. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity of presenting to NIBA, and thank you to Straits for sponsoring this. We're doing very well. If you would have ever said to me, you know, when I started on this lifelong love affair with futures, that I'd be running an exchange and sitting in my library in the house and watching $50-100 million trade with nobody in the office, I would have said, come on, John. It can't ever be like that. So we're doing just fine. We're enjoying ourselves. We're trying to make sure that us, our members, are all being well and staying safe.
Well, I would venture to guess that boredom is probably not a problem at your house. I'm guessing you and your wife have can find some things to do.
Yeah, it's a big week for us, you know. She's got a show. She's an artist and does virtual reality, so she's interviewing. She had a show open this week, and, you know, we're doing Bloomberg on Friday, and we've got you today, and a busy week talking to CEOs of our banks in advance of the launch of the 30-day AmeriBoer futures.
Well, that sounds great. So first off, can you give us a little brief history of AmeriBoer, how the notion came to you, how you started the AFX? This is a fascinating story.
Yeah, sure, John. I'm happy to do it. And you just cut me off if you think that we should be answering some other things. So we were sitting around. We sold our last exchange to ICE, the Chicago Climate Exchange, reformed an incubator. We're going to work on water markets. And the idea was promoted and really sparked by an article in the FT in 2011 saying the Royal Bank of Scotland was prosecuting four traders for manipulating LIBOR. John, even I know it takes two to manipulate. So I figured if there was one, there was likely to be two. And if there's two, there is going to be four. And basically, LIBOR would ultimately lose its preeminence. And we were struck by the fact that everybody else had an IBOR, an interest benchmark offering rate. London had LIBOR, Europe had Euribor, Hong Kong had HIBOR. And we said to ourselves, this is crazy. The U.S. is the largest economy of the world, and it doesn't have its own benchmark. Everybody else does, and we don't. So we started on a journey to build an American benchmark that was based on everything that LIBOR wasn't. It would be it would be transparent, it would be regulated, and most importantly, it would be based on real transactions. And we would just try to build a fintech, a lending platform for America's banks, except the big ones, the regionals, midsize, and communities, where they could lend and borrow from each other, as well as from other financial institutions and corporates. We went for 3 years and visited 125 banks around the country. My platform changed. I used to go to London and Paris and Singapore and Shanghai, and now I found myself in Tupelo, Mississippi, Bentonville, Arkansas, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Fargo, North Dakota, Kansas City, Memphis, Nashville. And we built a following and a community of people. We got a big push when the Fed formed ARC. SOFR is their alternative to LIBOR, and people started paying attention. We teamed up with the SIBO, and they became our service provider. They operated the algorithms that we had developed, and they had a big compliance department. And we thought that this would be a good fit for them. We launched on December 11, 2015. We had four banks at the opening: MB in Chicago, Associated in Wisconsin, Old National in Indiana, and Frost Bank in Texas. And we did $13 million a day. We have grown now to 189 members, 145 banks, plus 1,400 correspondents. So we're roughly 30% of America's banks by numbers and 14% by assets. We've most recently and run it like a public company, and Chris Giancarlo, the former chair of the CFTC, has joined us at the second half of last year. We got IOSCO certified, and what that means is that's an international organization of securities regulators, and there are 19 core principles, including transparency, liquidity, and we had ourselves independently audited, and we launched, a 7-day futures and a 90-day futures in the second half of last year.
Sorry to stop you, Doc. Before we get to the futures contracts, I've heard you tell us this story before. Before we get to the futures contracts, give us a little flavor of what it's like to go visit all those places. I know you have a little story about barbecue that I've heard a couple of times.
Yeah.
But when I first heard this whole notion of a Maribor, it struck me as that, you know, you're talking, as you say, to the community banks, the smaller banks. You know, for a lot of Americans, the only time they care about interest rates is when they're getting a mortgage or getting a car or something like that. And these are the banks that are helping those people. And so you've really developed a real Main Street banking system as opposed to a Wall Street banking system. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, those people you met and the places you've been. I find it very interesting in the whole story.
Yeah, we found this really a great exercise. And I like to tell people that I can definitely recommend to anybody the best pulled pork, brisket, barbecue, every joint in Memphis, the Kansas City, and actually Joe's, which is an old gas station outside of Kansas City, is great as a place for dry rubbed ribs in Memphis. That's sensational. And just going around and speaking to people who are making loans to homeowners, you know, who know the high school principal like he was next door, that basically provide loans to dairy farmers in Wisconsin, to auto dealers in Memphis, to startups in Bentonville, Arkansas. You know, we're really proud of the fact we have the biggest banks in Indiana, in Arkansas, the top six in California. We include in Chicagoland Northern Trust, Wintrust, CIBC. And so we've extended to the regionals, which are Regents, KeyBank, Fifth Third, Huntington, Republic, First Republic of California. So it's been a fun experience to reconnect to the heartland. And we've also sponsored some academic research and had Jeremy Stein, who is the head of the economics department at Harvard, give a talk at Northwestern. And as you just said, John, these banks disproportionately have all of the, or a disproportionable amount of job creation to small businesses. And the current PPP program is a perfect example where our banks are leaders in processing loans for small and medium-sized businesses, and they're keeping the economy going.
And well, and then the kind of a byproduct of what you've set up too is that with all those diverse people participating, it's pretty hard for any manipulation to show up. You don't have any big hitters that are pushing people around because everybody's doing their own business and you're conglomerating all that data into one number, right?
Exactly. So instead of, you know, 5 or 10 big players doing everything in any given quarter, we've got over 80. And the good thing about it is you hit it right on the head. It comes from Texas and it comes from Birmingham, Alabama and Brookline, Massachusetts and San Francisco, California, and Fargo and Green Bay and Detroit. So we are representative of every region in the U.S., and that's what makes us America's interest rate.
Okay, that sounds great. Let's talk about the futures contracts now. So last summer, we launched the 3 months. And tell us about that one. Tell us about the new one. Who would use these vehicles to hedge? What kind of risk? The differences? Let's run down all the different contracts that are available now and are going to be available, you know, forthcoming.
So we got approval to launch 3 contracts from the CFTC. We being the CFE, which is where the contracts are listed, the same place that VIX is listed. So CFE got approval, and they are our service provider, to list a 90-day compounded in arrears based on the overnight SOFR rate. So we took the same approach. We have a 90-day compounded in arrears, and that would be an alternative to 90-day LIBOR or 90-day SOFR. Our difference is we are a risk rate. There's a credit premium. SOFR is a repo rate. It serves, and we support it unambiguously, but it serves the big banks more than it does the regional and mid-sized banks. We didn't list the 30-day, which we're now listing, and I'll tell you that in a second, of the reasons. We listed a 1 week, and the reason we listed a 1 week is twofold. Number one, the Fed, every 2 weeks, tell banks, how much liquidity they must have on hand. So the banks could lock in if the Fed says you need $300 million in liquidity between demand deposits, at that, et cetera. Oh, it can go and lock in the rate for a week or 2 weeks at a time. The 90-day was meant for loans. We didn't list the 30-day because we wanted to see what the convention would become. And recently, many of our banks are beginning to price loans to corporates based upon the average Ameribor rate in a given month. So you just simply take the average Ameribor rate for the month, and that becomes the settlement price for the 30-day. And the reason we're listing it now is this is, in my experience as an economist that events markets and gets them wrong a lot and sometimes get them right, that you have to build a cash market. That's a precedent to successful futures. Then you have to get the hedgers, which means you have to get banks using Ameribor, and the virtuous circle is completed when the banks make loans to corporates based on a floating rate. They then hedge it in the futures, or they use a swap who then hedges it into the futures. So this is the final circle of a 7 or 8 year journey where we not only are facilitating borrowing and lending among banks and non-banks, we are facilitating the complete hedging of that lending vis-a-vis swaps and futures.
Okay. You know, last summer, last August, when your 3 month futures opened, we started tracking that in some of the research reports, our MarketWorks reports that we publish. And initially, interest rates were obviously higher, and there was some good volatility, there was some good market action, but that's kind of gone away given what the Fed has had to do over the last couple of months. How else is the pandemic affecting just markets in general, Ameribor, the AFX? You know, what kinds of other developments have we seen because of COVID-19?
Well, I think number one, we're seeing a surge in volume on our exchange. As I said, we went from 13 million a day to 2.6 billion a day since we opened. And that surge in volume is important, John, in the following way, because if you're a small businessman or a small businesswoman in some, you know, city in America, and you qualify for a PPP loan with your local community, regional, mid-sized bank, that bank will lend you the money, but doesn't necessarily have the money from the federal government. So our platform allows them to borrow from each other while they're waiting for the check in the federal government. So we serve to bridge a gap. I think that the effect of COVID is pretty remarkable, that what we're seeing is a dramatic change in obviously the exchange world, and the floors were going to cautiously reopen. I think probably a lot of the listeners work from home. My entire staff works from home. It's not at all clear that a permanent impact will be to allow a lot more flexibility. We're clearly seeing podcasts. You know, I'm purchasing products like microphones. I'm doing Zoom conferences. I'm doing Zoom board of directors. I'm speaking to CEOs in my particular case that I would have to spend a day and a half reaching and a lot of money. So I can now go and visit with the CEO of Old National and Evanston and First Merchants in Indianapolis. And instead of starting out at 6:30 a.m. and flying to Evansville and driving to Indianapolis, flying back to Chicago, I can do in 80 minutes what took me 14 hours. And my CEOs tell me they're doing the same thing.
Well, and then you have to order in your barbecue, right?
And then it's really hard, you know. I'm now becoming a huge fan of DoorDash.
kind of byproduct from COVID-19, I really wasn't aware of it till I did a little research to talk to you today, is that the move away from LIBOR has people have lost interest in it a little bit because there's just too many things kind of to do. And it struck me that LIBOR, it's almost like the bad guy in the movies. You keep shooting them and killing them, and they keep coming back. You never know. You just have to keep working on it. Will it eventually go away?
Yes, I think unambiguously. And as a matter of fact, that we did a press conference last week. And in that press conference, a number of the reporters from the ABA and from the major financial publications asked Chris and myself what we think. And this is going away. This is a permanent stain on the banking name in London where it's developed. The Bank of England is against it. They will not have publications. I think you're right. It's fits and starts. And it's almost like Glenn Close in the movie with Michael Douglas, where everybody thinks she's dead and then pops out of a bathtub with a knife in her hand.
With a LIBOR t-shirt on.
With a LIBOR t-shirt on. So it doesn't, you know, you got to, as any Hollywood movie, you know, they kill the villain or the alien creature, and then there's always one less spurt of the alien coming back. And I think this is the case, that the alien's having this one less, you know, go at it before it eventually dies. But I don't think it's for sure that the central bank doesn't want it. The central bank in London doesn't want it. People are reluctant to change. They're making the change, and change takes time. You know, having been around, you know, new markets for the last 45 years, you think, you know, people forget it was really hard to sell people on financial futures, bond futures in 10 years. Thought it was all stupid. There was no need for it. It would never happen. That there'd never be a need for stock index futures, that there, you know, never be need for climate change or acid rain or any of these things. So the answer is, and for those people who are listening, if you get it kind of right, you know, early on, then there's enormous value to be created, whether you're a broker or you're a startup exchange, et cetera. So you get it kind of right as opposed to getting it totally wrong. If those are the choices, you want to be in the kind of right category. And we think Ameribor, it may not be today or SOFR, but by the end of 2022. There's even talk about LIBOR lasting a little longer, and the expression in the banking community is they actually have named it zombie LIBOR.
Okay, well, speaking of all the other markets that you've been watching and creating over the years, let's talk about a couple other markets. We saw negative oil prices a few weeks ago. You think that's just a kind of a one-time thing, or is this something we need to worry about going forward?
Well, I think it's a function of design, and you can design a futures contract. It's a philosophical question, but let me tell you that the negative oil prices happened because of limited storage space. That's what the negative price told you. That can be changed. You know, you basically have to have multiple delivery points or a cash settled contract, but you can price it and play a role in sending a signal that more storage has to be in place. And so any commodity could go negative if you design it to reflect the supply of storage. In the case of interest rates, which isn't a physical commodity like beans or crude, but is a financial instrument, that's a function of Fed policy. Last week, or in front of Congress, the chairman of the Fed said, we don't think we need that as a tool. And I think that policymakers and my fellow economists are not convinced that negative interest rates as a public policy have been worth anything in Europe, that they haven't spurned a turnaround. And I'm in the case that believes that would not be a good public policy. The Fed has lots of alternatives. And negative interest rates, I don't think, would best serve the country.
Well, you jumped ahead of me. That was my next question, because we've seen Fed funds, back month Fed funds have gone over 100, which implies a negative rate. And so I was going to ask you what you thought about that, but you beat me to the punch.
It's the right question.
We've also seen... kind of for fun, the price of eggs have tripled in the last month. Is it time to bring back egg futures like we had in the 60s?
It may not. This may be a one-time effect as opposed to permanent volatility. And my experience is you look for a couple of volatility measures. So I'll give you an example that you know, we had a credit squeeze in 66 and 16. Well, you had two moves. You had a move in 69 in a credit squeeze, and then you had one in 73, and then we launched financial futures in 75. You had two oil events, a 73 embargo and a 79, and then crude followed. So my rule of thumb as an inventor is you need two spikes in volatility. One doesn't make a trend. If you have a couple, maybe eggs fall into the category of permanent volatility. But we don't know yet. I'd wait for a second one.
Okay. So lastly, many people listening today may not know that beyond his illustrious career in financial markets, Doc Sander knows a lot about baseball. So, Doc, what are we going to do? The Major League, they kind of have a plan. They kind of don't. I mean, here in Chicago, we're used to our heartaches, but now we even have to wait for that. So what do you think is going to happen? What should they do?
You're not pushing away the national pastime. I have a couple of observations, and that falls into one of them. This is not going to change behavior permanently. It may be like Korea or Japan. We're going to come back without fans, and then we're going to have spacing come in, and then all of a sudden we're going to find that Moderna or Pfizer has got a vaccine, and we'll be back to normal after it's all said and done. And you just don't push apart, NASCAR, as we did this past weekend, or baseball or any other sport. And let me kind of put that in a broader context. I'm deeply concerned about the short run, the jobs that have been lost, the imposition of hardships of good, solid Americans. But as somebody who has lived through the Arab oil embargo in 73, the Fed and interest rates going to 20% in the 80s, the crash of the market in 87, the crash of the dot-com bubble, the Asian currency crisis, the Great Recession, and now today, every 10 years in my career, there's a 1-in-500-year event. And what happens is it's short-term, profoundly difficult, but coming over the other side, we're a nation of entrepreneurs. We embrace change. We're beginning to see it. We'll see it in baseball. We're seeing it now in financial services. We're going to come out the other end with telemedicine, and we're going to, it's a, somebody working in Silicon Valley and an iPhone that'll do blood tests and will take your temperature. And so a teaching and a high cost of education, that model will change. And we are a good people. And every time they throw something at us, our entrepreneurship, our embracement of technology, and our solid American character brings us to new highs. And I believe we're going to be at new highs 2 years from now.
Well, Doc, those are wise and good words to end on. I'd really like to thank you for spending some time with us today. This has been really fun and interesting. We wish you continued good luck with the AFX and Ameribor, and we hope to see you again in person really soon.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Please do give us any help you can, and look at Ameribor relative SOFR Fed funds and put it on your radar screen. And I have been, I am, and I always will be a fan of NIBA and you personally. So thank you.
Very good. This conversation with Dr. Richard Sander about Ameribor futures and a few other things has been brought to you by the NIBA. You can learn about the NIBA and the benefits of membership at thenIBA.com. We would also like to thank our sponsor, Straits Financial, for their support in the production of this podcast. Visit them at straitsfinancial.com. This is John Nelson. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.